What we're going to do at this point is to take a look at how these understandings of reality for women get out of whack. If it's true, or if we start with the assumption that how we identify ourselves, for example, whether it's in terms of relationships or in terms of our accomplishments is kind of a neutral thing, whether we identify our understanding of power as the ability to make things happen in our world, or whether it is to empower or as a neutral thing, the issue for the religious enterprise or the theological enterprise is how do things get out of whack in our lives? I mean, we're talking about sin, but I don't use that word usually because my experience with women is that women have a lot of trouble with that word. I don't know. Is that true in this group? The word sin raises yuckies in your stomach or whatever?
It doesn't fit. It just doesn't fit.
Or doesn't fit? Mm-hmm. Right.
It's sort of like you don't just experience sin or participate in sin. It's like you are. You know?
Well, that's a whole other, yeah. And I think there's some really good reasons for that. I mean, there are really good reasons for all these things. Mm-hmm. I think one of the hardest things for us to come to is to understand that there are good reasons why we have the experiences that we have, why we have the feelings that we have. It doesn't come from nowhere, and it doesn't come from nothing. I think what happens for so many of us so much of the time is we think it has to do with a character defect or flaw or something rather than a response to the environment in which we live. And I think that one of the basic difficulties in our culture is a denial of the fact that we come to be who we are and through our environment. And I'm talking about not just the created world out there, but because of the folks we live with and relate with, and because of the systems of belief under which we operate. I mean, there's a reason for these things. Not because we're somehow born defective. So, I know you can't see that list up there. Part two.
Maybe I should put it back up here so you can refer to it. Would that be helpful? Yeah. What I want us to look at now, and this is going to have significant implications for the gospel in terms of what will be gospel for us. I think I did it upside down. I did, didn't I? How do these things get out of whack for us? How do they go awry? How do they create problems? How do they become destructive? Use any of those words that works for you. Okay. And we only did it once. You know, it was confirmation, and the pastor was asking the boys to sign up to be acolyte, and I said, why can't girls be acolyte? Well, because those are the rules. Well, why are they the rules? Well, if you want to talk to the council about it, you can. Well, so I did, and they said, well, they couldn't see any reason why not. So I got another girl, Marion, to be an acolyte with me, but we couldn't wear the chalice and surplice. Isn't that interesting? We had to wear choir robes. We only did it once, and everybody made so much fun of us, and we're in those choir robes, we never did it again. So part of the reason that our identity goes around is the maleness of God. You know, and that's, you know, that's... people poo-poo this, and they say, you know, God's neither male nor female, but there really is something to this. There really is.
My church is doing some work with me now because I have this episode, crisis episode, and identifying my father, the male image, and my dad, going back with family history, and then portraying that image on God, and that's how I interpret what I what God tells me to do.
I think that that comes out, and I am able to laugh at it now when people say, intellectually now, it doesn't matter, and no, God is not a he, but when you start referring to God as a she, radical, blank faces come across, people are taken aback, and it, so it does say, it says very loudly that God is a he.
Well, the other experience I had was in our women's group in church, Carol Toma came and did a little thing on feminist theology, and one of the women said, to think of God as a woman made her sick to her stomach. And I thought, that's how we feel about women, you know, thinking of God as a man doesn't make her sick to her stomach. Well, that was real.
Well, maybe there's lots more to that.
I think sure, there's lots to it. But
I think there may be a power issue.
Yeah.
That we have been taught that God is omniscient, omnipresent, and God is, can do whatever God chooses. Mm-hmm. And then we grow up in a society that says what is powerful is male and what is weak is female. And if we project them female onto God, we've taken away some aspect of God's power, and that could make someone
resist.
And I had a conversation with a couple of men 3 or 4 weeks ago, and actually a little longer than that, but we got talking about issues around the war and the fact that God was on our side, and that God was a warrior God, and then I said, well, does that mean that God is only male? The warrior image is predominantly, almost exclusively male, and they said yes, and I said, does that mean that God has masculine genitalia? And they said yes. And does God have breasts?
No way.
But I should suggest that there was any feminine characteristic of God really offended them. And then I said, I asked the question, well then how do I find myself in God? If there is nothing feminine about God, how can I be in God's image? And neither one of them had an answer.
Because there is no answer to that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and this is profound. And it, you know, if you think this is just today and this is just now, it ain't. It ain't. One of the things that Rhian Eisler says in her book, The Chalice and the Blade, is that one of the most stunning and outstanding thing about Hebrew religion is the absence of the feminine in anything having to do with God. She says this is unique among ancient religions. The absence of the feminine, the warrior god, that goes in and rapes and pillages and so, in the name of God, for God's sake, sends them in to do this. I mean, in the early writings of the Church Fathers, there was a belief that in the resurrection, females would be turned into males. Thomas Aquinas' theology was that nature reproduces itself perfectly, and the perfect reproduction of itself is the male. And when a female is produced, it's because something has gone awry in the perfect course of nature, such as a moist southwest wind passing through at the moment of conception, which disturbs the perfect course of nature. So if you have some sort of sense of essential wrongness in your being, there's good reason for that. That is part of your history. I mean, that there's a wrongness about being female. you know, the masculinity of God, and the way that gets, the way that gets experienced by us and becomes destructive to us in so many ways is that we're too much shaped by others. Others define how we're to be. Or I think, well, what other people say in terms of what
it doesn't fit. Even if I call it something different and have all this background, just the spiritual thing that came up inside me has to do with the inside of myself, and then you try to present that to the world, it doesn't fit.
You mean the world doesn't receive it? Is
no,
that what you're saying?
It doesn't fit in anything. I go to church and it doesn't fit. It doesn't fit here, it doesn't fit there. This thing I discovered inside myself doesn't fit anywhere, and so then I think I am crazy.
Right.
And the thing inside is the right thing, and all this other stuff is.
Yeah.
But how are you ever going to find that out? So you're a good man.
Until you find out how destructive it is to you, to constantly. Other things in terms of destructiveness.
I've got a question. I wonder, you know, like historically, where that begins. I mean, I think innately we are more powerful than men are. We speak earlier, we walk earlier, we toilet train earlier, we produce babies. I think innately we are more powerful, and I'm wondering where that, you know, historically, where did that come from? That self-doubt and self-denigration.
The masculine interpretation of that is, you know, that it's always been that way. That the male has always been, that culture has always been organized around a dominator model. And a masculine model that goes all the way back to the cave drawings. Remember what I said, you know? The work that Rhianne Eisler has done in her book again, The Chalice and the Blade, is that in reality that earlier this came about, this whole reorganization of society was a shift from a partnership model in which a goddess was worshipped. And not so much, and the whole notion of what the greatest thing about life was, the empowerment and the ability to give life and to bring life, you know, and that there were these marauding tribes all over in Europe and in the Middle East, and the Hebrews were among them, with a male god and a dominator culture, and basically wiped out the whole partnership model of social organization, which was also egalitarian. It wasn't matriarchy, she says. It wasn't women on top of men. That's what sociologists or anthropologists often suggest, is that if we don't have patriarchy, what we had before patriarchy was matriarchy, which is the domination with women dominating men. Well, the evidence, the archaeological evidence, shows that that wasn't true. Did have women in leadership positions, but there was great egalitarianism between the sexes. It was times of, you know, these are the times of goddess worship, great peacefulness, great creativity, and so on. Where did it come from? I mean, historically, I think the only thing that we know is that these marauding bands came in, these warrior bands, and I mean, read the Old Testament. I'm sorry, but it's there. Go into the land of Canaan and destroy everything. And take the sacred images of the people. Destroy them. At the Holy War, killing men, women, and children, wiping out entire cities.
You know, I remember a while ago, East West Journal did a whole thing on circumcision, and you guys saw the thing last night. I'm just wondering if there's some connection there, that early wound for the man. This article was saying that in a way it changes consciousness for the growing boy. It brings about more early intellectual development and a desensitization of feelings.
Would it then? What would have to follow then is that boys who are not circumcised would have a different experience.
Mm-hmm.
It would be an interesting study. Okay, anything else about how our self-identity gets out of whack?
Time.
Huh?
My biggest reaction is when these responsibilities that I have taken on take up more time, it's hard to find time for myself.
So responsibilities to what?
Others. You find it when the children are sick for a couple of days, the routine gets broken.
In other words, what you're saying is that your life and your identity get subsumed by the life and identity and the needs of others.
Women do that more than men.
Huh?
Women do that more than men.
Oh, yeah.
And men resent it more.
But women and women who become defined, I don't think we have so much of that issue among the women here, but in the general population, I mean, this is kind of a sophisticated group of women, but in the general populations, the identity as, in terms of the other, in terms of mother, I mean, my identity is entirely linked to who I'm related to, as mother, wife. You know, and there's been a great cultural rejection of that, you know, and shift in that. But when there's too much other, there's a real sense of brokenness, isn't there? There's a real, something is wrong in our lives. And when women tend to, when things tend to go awry, we're talking about sin here, folks. For women, it tends to be, in some fashion or another, in some way or another, there's too much other and not enough self.
So is that the sin then?
The too much other?
The too much other?
No,
I don't believe that. Absolutely. Whether it's the other who's defining me, whether it's, you know, whether it's my role, whether it's...
It makes an idolatry of someone or something.
It's a good way of naming it. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So you know, I had come to this point, and then I started going back into the Bible and the words of Jesus, and I had this dream or image sensation of, and what I had asked God was that somehow I could be freed up from this image of him with a beard and a white robe and sandals, and I had to have some other kind of image. And I tried, because I'm so totally other-directed, I had gotten to this point, and then what came back at me, and I don't know, maybe we're going to deal with this theologically or whatever, but his words, like, it is only when you lose your life, you find it. It's only in forgetting self that you find it. I mean, and listen, this is really right, and I'm stuck, you know. It's because I can't put that together, and so then my image, well, it's all screwed up.
Yeah.
and we can't forget that Jesus said over and over and over and over again, to women, it's recorded more often than men, your faith has made you whole. Or well, or whatever. And what we get hung up on is this lose yourself.
Right. What do you think for men, how does their identity get out of whack?
When they're failing in the outside world somehow.
Work goes crazy.
And too much self. Too much pride. Too much ego. Who defines me? Nobody defines me. I define myself. I mean, in talking with men, they have said this. Now, what did they say? Their self-identity, their identity had to do with self, their doing, and their image. So for them, it's like when it gets out of whack for men, it's when there's not too much other, when there's too much what?
Deny yourself. Take up your cross and follow.
Do you see? You see where we're going theologically?
Say that again.
Love.
So that's the message they're constantly preaching to us, and we take it and we go,
right. That's what I'm saying. The gospel, what we have been taught is gospel, which is the freeing word, is indeed free for people who have too much self. Not for for people who have too much of it.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
But we're getting ahead of ourselves. We'll get there. Let's focus on our sin, because we like to do that real well. What was the next one? Intimacy? When women fail to realize that the relationship is gone or that the relationship is destructive, and they maintain, and I mean, most women will hang on and hang on. I mean, if we're going to err, it's not jumping ship to quit, is it?
No.
It's hanging on and continuing to be abused in some way through fractured trust, through dishonesty, you know, and, well, he didn't mean it, she didn't mean it, you know, and yeah, somehow a failure to really discern, a failure for self-care. And I think that's what I'm reading and what you're saying, Sharon, about fractured trust, not the trust that you trusted somebody and it was betrayed. Betrayal. Your experience with the person, Julie, who abused you. Betrayal. Did anybody have anything on their list like trusting too easily? Or prematurely gets them into, anybody gotten into trouble by being too self-disclosing to somebody? How many have had that experience?
Not recently.
I labeled it on my sheet as a dysfunctionally based intimacy.
Which, by which you mean?
Is a whole spectrum of revealing too much about oneself too soon, mm-hmm. Crossing, allowing others to cross boundaries that are not boundaries of self, where it may be a sexual boundary, or it may be simply letting somebody unload on you when you haven't the emotional ability to deal with what it is they're unloading. All of those issues around dysfunction. I think it's very interesting that it takes the average woman who leaves an alcoholic relationship 10 to 12 years to leave. It takes the average man who leaves an alcoholic relationship, where the woman is the alcoholic, 2.5 to 3 years. So men won't stay with that dysfunction anywhere near as long as women will.
And why do you suppose that is? What's the link between this and this?
We get our identity from
our
relationships.
What is your problem that you're concerned because I have a couple of beers? What is the matter with you? It's that religious upbringing you've had. You're just too rigid.
And I think the male side of that is there's nobody to take care of me. If the woman is mm-hmm. absorbed in the bottle, then she's not there to help the man.
Yeah, another really important work by Peter Rutter, Sex in the Forbidden Zone, talks about one of the myths that both men and women hold about women is that women are in this world to care for men. At a deep level, both women and men believe that. Deep. So when caretaking is absent,
then they'll find somebody else to do it. 10 years
younger. Again, not all men, but
you know. 10 years
Right. For women, women for whom, you know, their friendship and intimacy and connection is really significant in their lives, intimacy and friendship is fairly easy, or natural, I guess I want to say, for women. Often where the problem is incurred is that they trust too quickly. They do not discern who's trustworthy and who's not. They become, they presume trustworthiness rather than discerning the spirits or, and often where intimacy and friendship
goes awry for them is an experience of betrayal. I have been betrayed. Women assume that people are on their side until it's demonstrated to them otherwise. And they're always a little bit surprised. Men do not assume that. They assume others are against them until they are either rise to the top through greater power, or they prove themselves. I was asked to come into a congregation in Seattle and prepare them for a woman pastor, and one of the things that I said to them is, I don't know about your new pastors coming in, but I'll tell you one thing typically is true, is most women who come into a job presume that you're on her side. She'll presume that you're on her side. And when women get really wounded as pastors in church, it's because of a profound sense of betrayal. Because you're not on her side. And I said to them, if the kindest thing you can do to this incoming pastor is if you are not, you know, women can handle that people are, you know, chugging around. Be honest with her. That's where the betrayal happens. The presumption that the pastor, the doctor, the psychologist, the one who ends up abusing is on your side and is wishing you well. Or the uncle or the parent or the father. Does anybody have anything else around intimacy and friendship? One other thing I want to say about, I should have said it in the last section, but I forgot, and I want to end up here. For women, intimacy and friendship is based on shared vulnerability. If I can't be vulnerable, if I can't share my weaknesses with you, I can't be a friend to you. Right? Then we can play, we can go have tennis and that sort of stuff, but I can't really be a friend. For men, friendship is based on strengths. For men, I also, it's important for you to know that intimacy is very frightening for men. Well, this has to do with, you know, some psychologists talk about having to separate from mother and all that. So I don't know about that, but it's true. It's scary to them. For women, it's comforting. I think another thing that in terms of women is, and this goes along with the fractured trust, the failure to realize relationship is old, is broken or destructive. Let me put it that way. Destructive is one of the ways that friendship gets out of whack for women is because of the easiness of their being vulnerable is they fail you to protect self in a relationship. Like if I'm in a relationship with you, then I have to be totally vulnerable, and I'm not aware that I have a right and a responsibility to protect myself, to discern when a relationship is being destructive, when things aren't as they appear.
I don't know how to put it into words, but about things seem to be going awry, I tend to take responsibility for what's going awry.
And I go fix it fast, and make it better so that it'll be like it's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm. That's why we keep hanging in there, too, because if it doesn't make it, it's our fault.
Right. Assume, good point. Assume I'm at fault.
Happens in battering relationships. I can change him if I cook the eggs differently next time. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And when you're already oriented toward death, that's an excellent example. You know, the reason that I got beat up was because, as he told me, I burned supper. You know, if I would just quit burning supper,
the problem is located in me. Well, I'm already focused on my identity. Others define my reality and my identity, and then I'm told that. And the piece that's missing, the failure to protect self, that I have a right not to be hurt physically, the piece that is missing is that in the next house, when that husband comes home and finds the dinner is burned, instead of getting a beating, she gets taken out to dinner. Oh, burn the dinner is a great excuse for us to go try that new restaurant.
Where can we find it?
Start burning the dinner.
Right, so the woman tends to believe that she's at fault when a relationship goes awry, and she's also often told that.
A piece in there, too, I think, is that's not up there is, you know, either accepting or confusing sex as implicit.
It isn't my responsibility. I mean, maybe we're getting into responsibility.
We are.
But it's sort of tied in with leadership, in that I think sometimes we think that we're the only ones, that we're the leaders, and that we have to do all of this.
And what's
super
the consequence
stuff
of that? Not just on ourselves, but on others.
Well, you're denying them the opportunity to assume that leadership role for themselves.
Right. We call it in the whole addiction thing. We call it codependence or rescuing. We call it rescuing. And we don't allow others to bear the consequences of their own behavior, you know. We don't enable others to become responsible for themselves. So in fact, being overly responsible, and I think they are appropriately put together because we do put them together.
I took on power more, I guess, in that vertical when somebody is telling me to do something, and it's not something that I feel I should have to do, that it's a moral issue that I shouldn't have to do it. I'm disagreeing with what somebody else thinks I should be doing, primarily in the work area. And then I guess at home some, when there are household chores that my husband thinks I should be doing, maybe. But the power thing is more in the job, and so disagreeing with that and still having the need to do what my boss says because he is the boss.
So it gets out of whack for you when, can you say that in a sentence?
When I disagree with what I should be doing.
So like when there's a conflict between your sense of what's right and what somebody else thinks there is?
Yeah. And the other thing is that I liked the definition of power as the capable of making changes.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. And so I was talking about changes. And when somebody makes changes in my life, that then I can't live with, but I think, well, I should be able to. So then I start thinking, why can't I? And the wrestling with it to when I finally say, I can't live with those changes that you're making.
And finally exert your own power.
Right. Mm-hmm. And say, oh, well,
so when your experience of when power gets destructive, you're talking about power that other people have over you.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
How about your own power as empowerment? Does your whole sense of being powerful as a person who empowers ever become destructive?
Yeah,
out of whack? Yeah.
I was just thinking about that in terms of volunteerism. I mean, if women have nothing else, they can always sign up for another committee or volunteer to do something. And at a certain point, I mean, and I work with so many women who are just totally community activists and, you know, on everything. And it's at a certain point, I mean, that's the only power really they have in their lives. I mean, to make those choices, to get over-involved. And then that tremendous guilt, and part of that's the responsibility to carry through with your commitments. What happens is there's no way to back out without, losing what little power you have, but also just try to put that together with your, you know, and the guilt of not finishing what you said you'd do. And
well, nobody will like me.
It's tremendous among women.
The way I've said that is that the empowerment is for others only at the sacrifice of self. Yeah. That who empowerment is for others.
Right.
And my identity is only when I'm empowering others.
Right.
And how that becomes destructive is the loss of the sense of empowering myself. It's always other directed. Is that?
Yeah.
Boy, that theme went through every single question that came up. I could relate. The time element is not there for me to identify with almost any of the issues, any of the intimacy identifying with myself. That's a new concept. I don't identify with myself. I identify with others all the time. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard to even chat about and talk about a lot of these things because when you're other-oriented, there's no time. I don't have time. And I'm constantly unsettled
right.
And a knot in my stomach. And something's not right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because of not dealing and thinking about the internal things.
When you sacrifice yourself, you know, when you care for others at the sacrifice of yourself, this is destructive.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. This is destructive. The one thing that we haven't come up here with here in terms of how the notion of powers and empowerment becomes destructive is manipulation. Mm-hmm. Anybody put that down?
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, when we don't exercise freedom of choice, when we don't empower ourselves in a healthy way, the two things that happen, I think, are manipulation or, you know, controlling and coercion.
Right. We talk about it as empowerment, but what's really going on is manipulation, which devalues somebody else. And you know, the whole thing about all women as women's wiles and women as manipulators? Well, there's some truth to that. There's some truth to that, I think. And that's because manipulation, don't you know, is the power of the powerless.
Mm-hmm.
Think about your kiddos. If you can't use power directly, you're going to manipulate.
Yeah.
And that's destructive. Manipulation is destructive to other people as well as to ourselves.
And yet it's very strongly reinforced. When a child manipulates to get what they want, and they get what they want, the reinforcement is so powerful.
Oh, because it's effective.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But mom manipulates kid to get what she wants, and that's okay because she knows what's right for her kids.
And in some cases that's true.
Mm-hmm.
And mom does know what's right.
But does she have to manipulate it to do it? Does she need to manipulate to get the end result?
I don't know. I'm not a parent. You have to answer that.
She shouldn't have to.
Pardon?
I think it's unhealthy to do that.
Straight not.
Do you think that parents, women as mothers, also have difficulty exerting direct power on their children when that's appropriate? Is that part of what manipulation, I'm asking you, is that part of what the manipulation, as you see it, is about?
I can only speak out of my own experience,
yeah.
And I know that in the situations where I manipulated my children, and there were many of them, I knew no other avenue for getting them to do what I wanted them to do. But that is what I had learned, that is what I had observed in other people, and I wasn't aware of that there was another way to do something.
Mm-hmm.
I think drugs and alcohol play a big part in that. That sure messes up things too.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I'm a teacher, and I just took a workshop on self-empowerment for children. And what was said, what I thought was really an eye-opener for me, because I've taught for so many years, is that as teachers, we've always given directives to children, do this, do this. And as parents, we do this also. And the workshop was saying just the opposite. they were saying if you want children to be responsible for their own actions, what you give them the opportunity to do that by you instead of saying go pick up your clothes, you say you state that your room looks messy. Or you say, it kind of bothers me when your room is messy. And very often, it's amazing, I've tried this with kids and my own kids, they will go, oh, okay, and they will take the self-responsibility to do it. It's amazing how that works. Whereas if you say, go do that, there's something inside of them that just is like, it's a power struggle. It's like, I'm not going
to. Who likes to be overpowered? Yeah. I mean, even little ones don't.
Even I do this with my preschool students when it's cleanup time. I just state, oh, you know, Susie's picking up the blocks. I give all my attention to the kids that are acting responsibly and no attention to those that are not. And it's amazing. They just come around and they start doing, being responsible. But I'm not going, you go do this, you go do that, you go. Because when I do that, I get the opposite response. And I think that's, when you're talking about manipulation, maybe that's a way of manipulation, but it's also a way of getting them to bridge the gap between seeing what needs to be done, responding internally, and then acting on their own.
Or teaching responsibility, what it means to be.
Because what
if you're overly responsible, like I said before, what you deprive another person is the opportunity to learn responsibility and the consequences of their, you know, the most dramatic example, of course, always the examples with alcohol, with the alcoholic, that, you know, every time you rescue somebody from the consequences of their drinking, you perpetuate the, you know. There's one other thing here about power that I haven't heard, and maybe it's because it's too obvious and too subtle, or I don't know what. And that is, I think that women, we get caught out and things go awry for us because we think power is bad. Mm-hmm. And to be powerless is a virtue.
Well, there again is that theology of the servant, you know. I mean, trying to fit that in with power.
What was that?
It's a purple ash. It's a purple
ash. I wrote that on my first sheet.
Why?
About power, about fear of power. And was just sort of writing to myself, you know, one of the things that I realize is that for me to be powerful, for me to really access the power that I know is there, I also have to risk being seen by men in my world as a lot of real not nice kinds of things, you know. I'm too independent, I'm too autonomous, I, you know.
You're a bitch.
That kind of stuff. I mean, I have to give up this identity of a female that. Yeah.
I find myself, and I think, well, maybe as the adult in the group, I need to be the one to step in. I find myself refusing to step in because I will not take responsibility for it. I find myself lots of times. Well, I don't know what the group wants to do, and I'm not going to step in and take responsibility to where this group is going to go.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Okay,
and that part of power is bad, isn't it? That there's not appropriate time or place to lead or direct or exert influence or even force in some way.
Yeah. Is there a good time where it's appropriate? I don't know. I've never had the confidence or what to step in and say, hey, I think what we're doing here is inappropriate. This is better. Taking responsibility for the group.
Because if the majority of the group feels one way, then we must be wrong. That's how.
Well, there's also that.
I may be the only one.
Let them tell me. I don't necessarily find them letting me do it. I'll get up and walk away. And is that good or bad? I sometimes think, well, should I have stayed and stated my point and pushed it to a, to, I will not do that. I find myself, I will not do it. And I will not, part of my defense is, and then they can't tell me what to do.
That's a family issue.
Well, I think that's an undervaluing of self.
This is leading us to talking about leadership. Maybe we can scrunch this on here without going to another sheet. Go ahead, Marcia, and then I'll start.
Well, I was just thinking when you were talking, Phyllis, that you also brought up time right away as one of the issues of not having enough time for yourself, and what happens in a group. Often, if I take some leadership, I end up doing every damn thing myself. And so I shut up, and I don't want to do it anymore. And,
you know that, yeah.
And mm-hmm. I have, you know, it's sort of an either-or issue. I either end up doing everything, or I'm very quiet, and people think I don't have any ideas, or I'm not really making a contribution to the group. And there must be a happy medium here someplace. You don't have to have one or the other. How about the leadership then, Julie?
I find with leadership that women often end up, you know, taking positions where they have a lot of responsibility, but they don't have the corresponding power that goes with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Especially in the workplace, too.
Administrative assistant?
Without power.
Somebody has said
and this goes back to the thing about women being being so responsible. Mm-hmm. If it needs to be done, they'll do it. General.
They wanted a token female for a running club.
How about in leadership? Other things in leadership? I think maybe a better
language. I think things go awry in leadership. The Margaret Thatcher syndrome. When women attain positions of leadership by becoming more male than the males and continuing that same, those same values and those same ways of manipulating power that men have always used.
So what you're saying is there's women can misuse their leadership just exactly the same as men do.
Well, maybe they've only attained that power by being like the men until there's a critical mass of women in politics that may continue to perpetuate. Mm-hmm.
The notion of leadership in the world at large is not to guide, to help, to influence, to set example, to facilitate, but to get others to do what it is that needs to be done. And so very often women who rise to, do not rise to positions of leadership without fulfilling leadership in those kinds of ways.
I think that, and this made, I'll say it anyway, there are rules which we're not privy to from the beginning, I believe. And for young boys and men who learn those rules, they know how to use those rules in an appropriate manner. It's like when I went through college, I grew up playing football with my brothers. I went to college, they started playing powder puff football. I said, I am fucking not to play football with women who don't know how to play because they see it as, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to knock you over, and legs are broken and hands are broken. And so there's sort of an overextension or a misunderstanding of the rules. So that you have Margaret Thatcher's and other women who are moving up in power, and they try and learn the rules after the fact. They're still not totally privy to what they are, and so they get bent even further.
That's a real interesting, almost like a caricature or a, And I think that Catherine, that goes back to something that I said earlier, that men have told me, and it really surprised me, that men always have access to power. Power is always available. Men perceive that they always have the power is always available to them in some way, and maybe that has something to do with that they know the rules.
Yeah. In the mid-60s, Betty Harrigan wrote a book, Games Mother Never Taught You, mm-hmm. and it's about the male power structure and the rules that men learn through socialization. Mm-hmm. And men learn very early on that it takes 5 to play or it takes 11 to play, that you tolerate somebody in the system because that's what the system requires. Mm-hmm. You may not respect that person, you may not value that person in any way, shape, or form, but you need that person and you will use that person because you need them in order to play the game. Women don't learn that. Women learn if you can't get along, you go find somebody else to play with. That it's feminine to bicker. Women's girls' games are hopscotch, single, jump rope, single, jacks, single. Many of girls' games, at least up through the 60s, were self-oriented. And if you couldn't get along in a game of jacks, you could pick up your jacks and go home and play jacks by yourself till the cows came home. And so we didn't learn to interact, to be, to tolerate friction and live with it to accomplish the end that needed to be accomplished.
Another way of saying that is that, and this is one of the things I'm reading on Felice that includes men's responses, one of the ways the intimacy gets out of whack for them is that they use others for selfish gains.
That women use others?
Men.
That men.
Men use, and I think that speaks to that, men use others for selfish gains and make people into objects. Again, to tolerate the person to for my selfish gains is to, women are much less likely to do that. I don't have anything up here about leadership, how our leadership style, which is about facilitation and guiding and leading, how that gets out of whack and gets us into trouble.
I think sometimes it can be perceived as weakness because you're not, if you have a different leadership style where you're not telling everybody what to do, but you're trying to empower the group to make the changes or whatever, I think it's seen as you don't know how to do it, what's wrong with you. That's happened to me a couple times. Mm-hmm. It's also happened to my husband, who's has that kind of a leadership style, and one of his employees said to him, well, why can't you just tell us what to do? Don't you know what to do? And he said he just didn't get it, he just didn't understand his leadership style. And I think it's seen as weakness where it's not. I think that gets us into trouble. That's happened to me as a teacher when I've had people working with me, or I had a long-term substitute that I was training for a while, and I really wanted to affirm her ideas and help her to teach a way that was comfortable for her because it wouldn't work for her to do it the way I do it. But she saw that as I didn't know what to do, or I wasn't telling her what to do. And she
is there ever a time, though? This goes back to the whole notion of leadership as facilitation and empowerment. Is there ever a time to really take charge? Is it ever destructive? End up being destructive by not taking charge?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Of course. But we as women tend to see taking charge as so negative that it's hard for us, if men err be on the side of not knowing when to step back and let somebody grow on their own, women err on the side, it seems to me, when it becomes destructive for us, is we don't know when to step in and take charge. I think of classroom situations as I teach a lot of adults. And invariably, not this in this group, but very, very often there's somebody who absolutely dominates the group, who pushes their agenda onto the group, I mean, in fact, whose behavior within the group is destructive to the whole process that the group is going on. You know, you've had this experience a zillion times, right? And what do you say? Why doesn't the teacher do something about it? Well, see, I think as a teacher, my failure to do something about that is to not take charge of that situation and to set the limit on that person is destructive. To not take charge can be destructive. So to not know when, and I don't know if this is the case or not, with your student teacher, but sometimes to not give direct feedback and criticism and direct specific helps may not be helpful to her. I mean, there's a point at which
Yeah, I don't know either, but, and part of it is when I try to look at myself too and what I'm like, it goes back to this self-identity thing. Even with back to the friendship part of it too, I find that sometimes I get in the situation where then it happens that those people think they have to start taking care of me. And I don't know if that's my problem of not being assertive enough or what. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, like your student teacher feels like she needs to take care of
you? Well, that or it wasn't a student teacher, it was a substitute teacher, so it was a, an equal kind of a relationship. But, yeah, I felt like she needed, she felt like she needed to start telling me what to do because I didn't know, because I wouldn't tell her what to do or how exactly to do it. And then with friends, it's when try to empathize or listen as somebody's trying to go through things and maybe not give them. I never feel like I can tell somebody else what to do. Maybe that's part of the problem that you're talking about as a woman. I feel like I can tell somebody else. But then they look at it as trying to, then they start taking care of me. You know, I hate that. I get myself into that a lot.
Well, with the student teacher, is the student teacher out there to sit there and say, well, she told me to do this, and so if it doesn't work, it's not my fault. Sometimes I immediately think of the situation, well, yeah, I expect you to step forward, make a decision, act upon it, and live with the consequences. And does the student teacher out to want to sit there and take the easy route out, and you tell me what to do, and I'll do it, and if it doesn't work out, it was your fault. Now that's my that was my first reaction to that.
I think it has a lot. I think it has more to do with our Let's start at the beginning. We think there's this basic wrongness about it. We're totally oriented toward others. We don't have adequate boundaries, and we don't feel like we. And therefore, too often we don't know when to take charge. We think to take charge is always bad. We have a fear of power. We think power is bad. So we haven't been able to sift out when it's appropriate and when it's not. You know, it's like if we have this notion, we just give people enough room and just love them enough and just empower them enough, then everything will be okay, because that's really what we needed, you see. That's really what we needed. Mm-hmm. However, when you come to, and how I have finally really understood this is when it comes to people who exhibit offender behavior. And a person who's dominating a group discussion is exhibiting offender behavior. You don't love an offender, a sex abuser, or so on, I'll use the extreme, you don't love them into stopping their behavior. You don't empower, I mean, yes, that comes from deep-seated experiences of inadequate. The limits have to be set.
A failure to hold other people accountable.
Yes. And to set the limit, the tie, if you want to call it tie, I have a little trouble with some of what that means in practice, but the concept, when to say no, when to use power, when to take charge, power not as bad, you know. We're so always so afraid as women that we are going to overpower, you know, that we are going to do unto others what has been done to us, that we err on the side of undervaluing our own power and letting others cross our boundaries, letting others be destructive in the group, not that's the side that we err on. When men talk about how does leadership and how does power get out of whack and out of control, it's very clear, you know, it's when I become tyrannical, overpowering, I don't have any regard for others. That's how it gets out of whack for men, who have a sense of power that's given to them and available to them. To women who do not, that's not the way it generally gets out of whack. And that, all of these things, these are what we've talked about, is how things go awry or destructive. This is our sin. The implications of the differences in our sin and how men experience sin have a tremendous statement to make about what is gospel for us, doesn't it? And what we've been taught as gospel, which I believe in many, many cases has driven us further into our own sin. What we're going to do tomorrow is begin to put the theological application onto this material.